Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing, Steve?
Hey, John. I'm well. Great to be here.
Good, good. You should be happy to be here this week. We're lucky to have Brian McLaughlin, the partner and co-founder of MTech Capital. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Now, you're in the cross-section of two areas here, venture capital and really focused on insurtech. What got you interested and started in the insurtech side of the fintech world?
Well, it's funny. If you go all the way back, I started as a fintech investor at what is now known as Upfront Ventures. We had a different name back then, in 2002. And by 2005 or so, I was doing almost exclusively fintech. And then fast forward, as Upfront Ventures started to do less fintech and more Southern California investing, and I'm compressing some time here, my brother, who was at the time the global head of insurance investment banking at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, said, my clients only want to talk about technology. And this was 2016-17. And so in my estimation, insurance was more than a decade behind financial services in terms of adopting technology. And he said, I think we should do a fund. And so we started to iterate on the idea of what should an insurtech fund look like in 2017. And we actually stood the fund up in 2018. And we thought, we need an edge and insurance companies need help. And so we decided that our limited partners should be insurance companies and we would be their eyes and ears. And it was with that idea that we went out and raised our first fund. It's a $100 million fund and started to put it to work at the end of 2018. That's the genesis.
So interesting. So essentially you're saying that your LPs as insurance companies, not traditional pension funds, wealthy people, et cetera, et cetera. So you basically act as a CVC for numerous insurance companies. Is that sort of how you frame it?
The reason why we don't think of ourselves as a CVC is because we clearly separate two functions. One is scanning the market, right, to see everything in the insurtech world globally. And then separately is what we choose to invest in. And on that investing side, we are basically like any other venture capital firm. There's only two people on that investment committee. It's Kevin, who's my partner and brother, I mentioned, and myself. And it is our team of, you know, six investment professionals who really do all the diligence, make the decision, and decide what the portfolio should look like. Now, in that other element of our business, which is scanning the entire market, we share those insights with all of our limited partners who are insurance companies and brokers. So we make it clear, you're helping us build an ecosystem. Entrepreneurs want access to the 100 plus insurance companies that we talk to. A handful of those are investors in our fund, but we talk to many, many more. And so entrepreneurs want access to that ecosystem. And our limited partners want the insights we glean from it. And so we're showing them 60 to 70 companies every month. We're highlighting the 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 that they should be interested in that month. And we may not invest or want to invest in any of them, but they might be relevant to that limited partner. The ecosystem is really powerful. It makes us better as investors. We have genuine insights that we can share with our limited partners, and the entrepreneurs really love it.
Does your LP's willingness to partner with a startup company that you're looking to invest into, does that also affect whether you invest in the company or not?
In terms of, is there any influence that our limited partners have on whether or not we invest? Does it even come into our consideration set? The answer is no. We're purely financial investors. We're trying to drive the top returns possible. And if there's a strategic interest that one of our limited partners might have, it is not important to us. And we tell them that, you know, here's a company. Now it's up to you. We're happy to make an introduction. And if you want to buy the business, have them become a vendor, some other strategic partnership, you should go ahead and do that. And we may invest, we may not invest. And those are completely separate.
So you have so much experience in the insurtech side of the world. Are there other funds that focus just on insurtech? I haven't heard of it.
Funny, there are. It's again, it reminds me of fintech circa 2005. Just a handful. A couple in the US, a couple in Europe. And each of us goes at it a different way. And in fact, I just saw the FT Partners almanac that they did on InsurTech for 2021. And, you know, MTech Capital is the second most active investor that they cover globally. I think we did 14 transactions in 2021 to give you a sense. But there's only a handful of names on that list. Now, there are generalist firms that have, you know, maybe individual partners that like InsurTech. But we have an entire team that does it, you know, every day of the week. And we interact with all of our LPs on a monthly basis to exchange information, dialogue.
Yeah, so many fintech areas have just boomed. I mean, maybe a bubble kind of area in terms of valuations. Payments comes to mind with the Stripes, Marqeta's, Bolt's, Checkout.com having these tens of billion dollars of valuation. And not all of those will live up to that. How does that compare with the market on the insurtech side of the world?
I'll tell you, we've had a handful, maybe the most obvious to the public markets is the IPOs, de-SPACing that occurred in 2021 with, call it four or five insurtechs, think Lemonade, Hippo, and the like. And guess what? Those haven't traded so well in you know, Q4 and into Q1. You know, my personal point of view is, you know, those management teams probably thought, hey, I think we can be a public company. I really do like the valuation. And boy, they're offering us a lot of capital.
Well, it's hard to say no.
Yeah. And in that combination, they might even convince themselves that they can be a public company. And if you don't have your loss ratios sorted out, and you don't have your cost to acquire sorted out, and you can't really instrument your business, the public markets really don't like it. And then they hit the ejector seat. And that happened within 6 months for a lot of those companies. And they're down, you know, 70, 90%. In some cases. So not pretty at all. Now, yeah, were they overvalued to begin with? Yes, they were.
Yes. I'm glad you're not afraid to just call it. You know, yeah, I've seen some buyouts where the price didn't live up to the last private round or some like companies you were saying that fell out. Do you see any, or what do you see as the odds of a wider bust in this very, like you said, in some areas, a very inflated market?
The mini bubble, as it were, really occurred with the public markets being hot and SPACs as vehicles, right? The fundraising around SPACs also being very hot. And that's hot money almost by design, right? When you raise money in a SPAC, you have 24 months in most cases to put it to work. And if you don't, you have to give the money back. And so there's a race that occurs as soon as you raise capital in a SPAC that you have to find a good partner to de-SPAC with. And so I think was really the driver of that bubble. In the broader late stage market, yes, prices are high, but they've been high across all of venture. There's nothing that I'm seeing specifically in insurtech in late stage private financings that make it feel like it's any different from the broad venture market. And by the way, when companies are raising $100 million in some private financing, you know, by and large, they have a pretty good business. And yes, the valuations might be ahead of themselves, but it doesn't feel like, you know, a bubble. And it certainly doesn't feel like, you know, 1999, 2000. Because these are real companies, in my view, anyway.
Right. And it's also it's worth noting that because you play in the insurance space, this is a massive part of the economy. I've read that maybe 3 million Americans are employed by the insurance industry in one way or another, either directly or indirectly. I think premiums are something like 1.5 trillion or something like that in the order of that. So it's just it's a huge space. But when you look at companies to invest in, because again, this is such a massive space, what are you looking into? What sort of the profile, if you have one? And how do you think about disruptions to the industry?
Yeah, and by the way, very similar to fintech. And I know your focus as a podcast is probably primarily on fintech. And it really just feels like fintech circa 2005, 2007. And if you look at, you know, number of transactions, fintech versus insurtech, you know, 2021, there were $14 billion of transactions, of financings. That's probably where fintech was in maybe 2014. So maybe we're ahead of ourselves on volume, but by number of deals, you know, still a fraction of what's going on in fintech. And so we're just early days in what you've already pointed out is a massive and global market. And there really hasn't been any disruption yet. Really not at all. And so there are a lot of angles, that one can take when investing in the sector. The most obvious probably is, hey, listen, I'm a consumer. I want to buy auto insurance. I want to buy homeowners insurance. And the incumbents are terrible. I can't buy insurance at 11 o'clock at night. I don't really want to talk to a broker. I just want to shop myself. How do I do that? And there have been a good number of entrepreneurs who have said in the last 5 years, I should build a great e-commerce experience for insurance. And I love the business model, whether I'm a broker or I'm going to be a full stack insurance company. I love the renewal stream. I acquire the customer once, they pay me annual premiums. And if it's homeowners insurance, then I do a good job. They'll come back, you know, I'll have 90%+ retention in my customer base. So the economics can look fantastic. And then the challenge is you have to compete with some of the biggest brands, in the world. And if you talk about the US market, it's Progressive, Geico, State Farm, some of these companies are 100 years old. And so
you mentioned, international markets. What markets do you see opportunities in outside of North America? What markets get you excited?
Yeah, well, about 50% of transactions are done outside the United States, to give you a sense of the level of innovation going on.
VC transactions?
Yep, that's okay. Right. Believe it or not. The U.S. market used to be 60% plus just 3 years ago. Now it's shrunk below 50%. And if you look at where's the real activity, once you leave the United States, it's Europe. And then after that, probably Latin America. Yes, the Asian market, I think because we don't cover Asia fully, at least not with Fund One, we just didn't have a team that was large enough to cover the Asian market. I have less insight there. But I'd be surprised if they're more than 25% of transactions.
What do you see exciting in the Latin American market? Why or what's going on there?
In Latin America, this is, it's a story of a growing middle class and, the need for insurance. If there are going to be more cars in your family, if you're going to buy your first home, you are going to need insurance. So in personal lines, it's really exciting. And they're, higher growth economies. So even on commercial insurance, there are opportunities just as those markets develop.
Looking at the actual subset of the investments that you make right now, you mentioned we went through Lemonade, we went through Geico, State Farm, et cetera, is there a particular subset of insurance that you think is more ripe for investments and for a new player to come in and kind of disrupt the space?
Yeah, they're probably the biggest new category of insurance in the last 10 years is cyber insurance. And it's one that insurtechs have really gone after. So if you think of Corvus, Cowbell, Coalition, AtBay, these are cyber insurers often selling into the SMB or mid-market, primarily in the United States. And all of them have raised hundreds of millions of dollars at valuations from $1 to $3 billion. So in terms of a new category that's been embraced by technology entrepreneurs, you'd have to start with cyber. Now, if you go back a little bit, it was probably pet insurance, another new category.
Pet insurance, right? Interesting.
Yeah. And so it was a new wave of entrepreneur, go back to 2008 even, where pet insurance was a relatively hot market. And, of the top 10 that got founded in the last, 15 years, I wouldn't be surprised that 8 of them have already been purchased by an incumbent insurer who needed a product. Yeah. That has not yet happened really in cyber.
On the cyber side, I keep seeing these warnings lately about a possible Russian cyber attacks or, even just side effects of that if something gets out. Has that played into those prices? Do you have any insight on how the thinking is on that?
I can comment on pricing in the last 12 months, not necessarily in the last, 6 weeks, where there's been a big move. But the market has a term of art is when a market hardens, it means prices are going up. Because insurance carriers think their loss ratios are too high. So they feel like they have to raise prices and be more careful in their underwriting. And that has definitely happened in the cyber market. And the chief driver of that has actually been ransomware. These ransomware attacks and the payments that result from them.
It's like a big industry, essentially, where there's suppliers and resources for people to actually perpetrate these kinds of ransomware.
That's right.
Really interesting area. That's a whole other podcast. But on the pet insurance, these are like medical bills, or if the dog disappears, or how does this work?
I'm sure there are a variety of products out there. The standard one that when I think about pet insurance is basically it's health insurance for your pet, right? So it's how many visits a year are covered? And what if my pet needs surgery, right?
Right. You hear nightmare stories about these crazy expenses for pet procedures.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
A surgery can be $5,000 to $15,000 for your pet. And if you're uninsured, the choice is pretty stark.
I don't think my wife would spend that much on me even, so.
Put him down.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you've heard her. Yeah. The first sneeze and she says that.
Yeah, we've all heard crazy stories of, a family is put in that spot and all of a sudden somebody is writing a very large check to a veterinarian.
Yeah, it's funny. My family just got a puppy maybe a month ago or so, and we still haven't got insurance. So we're thinking about it, but I think there's a calculus as to whether, what's the amount that you want to spend to actually save this puppy? Is it $500? Yeah. Is it $5,000? Right? It's a much more cold hearted sort of calculus than if you were a person.
Exactly, and in a world where certainly in the United States, where your pet is a member of your family, it's not as easy to just say, yeah, we're not going to spend that. Forget it.
Right, right. I think famously in San Francisco, there are more pets than children. So I think we know which way they would go.
We do have a preference, yes.
You do, yes. But going back to the insurtech and the fintech side, as a capital allocator and an investor, I'm curious, how do you determine which companies to invest in? Is it a matter of looking at the founder and their history, the industry they're playing into, their technology? Sort of, how would you rank the things that you look at that would help you decide whether to invest in the company or not?
If they've been on the fintech newscast, that's a big plus.
That's a big plus.
Yes.
It's a big signal.
If,
yes.
if you guys have found them, we're ready to write a check.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. But to answer your question, though, it also depends on stage. And so we invest across stages because we're focused exclusively on InsurTech. The expertise we bring is valued by entrepreneurs we found, whether we're leading their seed round with our $3 million check, or oftentimes it's less than that. It's $1.5 million, let's say, or we're writing a $3 million check into their $30 or $40 million round. We're able to invest across all stages because of the resource that we represent for the entrepreneur. And so what we focus on varies by stage. But if you want to start with, seed stage, oftentimes pre-product, it is about the entrepreneur and the team he or she has assembled and their vision for the business and whether we believe they can execute on it. And so we have a company that'll be coming out of stealth here in the next quarter. And it's a digital agency serving the Hispanic market with some unique propositions around payments that we think is going to be really exciting, and it's going to be embraced by the Hispanic market. And the entrepreneur is himself Hispanic and has built an entire team that really understands this market. And so that was very much about the vision of the entrepreneur, our belief that this person and the team are going to execute like crazy and build a big business and serve customers really well, right? And then you get to the later stages, and it's entrepreneur has already proven him or herself, right? So how much room is there for this company to continue to grow at, let's say, 50 to 100% plus? And if you get that wrong and you pay too much, you're going to have lousy returns. But if you can identify a company that still has a ton of runway and an entrepreneur that is ready to scale with the business, or if not, is planning for the day that he or she wants to step down to give it, turn over the keys to a more professional manager, that's stuff we pay attention to.
We have seen actually a lot of interesting developments in the past year or so in the VC space, where I think it was maybe late last week, Sequoia announced that they're launching a program that sounds basically like an incubator type of thing, which is something that traditionally VCs haven't done before. We've also seen other companies also, or other partnerships rather, get into the space and also now seek to invest in public companies in addition to private companies. And I'm wondering, this is creating sort of a blurring of the lines between, private equity and VC and equity investments as well. How do you foresee the industry, the VC industry, will change in terms of the kind of targets that they go after? And what do you think of all these changes also in the industry that I mentioned in terms of Sequoia and companies being able to invest in public markets and private markets as well?
I think it's fascinating. You take as an example, think of the growth and changes that occurred in the buyout business from, let's say, 1985 to today. And you say, well, these companies went from having a buyout fund, then a bigger one, then a bigger one, to becoming financial services supermarkets for all alternatives. So you look at, Blackstone today, and it's now, I don't even want to make up a number. It must be north of 400 billion of AUM. Someone will correct me, I'm sure. I believe their real estate portfolio alone is 300 billion plus, something like that. And this was a firm that in the late 80s had a couple billion dollar, buyout fund. Mm-hmm. And so, and they're all global now. And you could put Carlyle Group on that list, and you could put KKR on that list. And now you're seeing that in venture, right? No one looked like, the SoftBank Vision Fund until SoftBank did it. And now you have Tiger Global. You have Iconic with probably $12 billion under management for tech investing. It's astounding how these firms have grown. And I think if you're Sequoia, and listen, I'm in the cheap seats. I just know what I read in the press. They're probably looking at their brand and saying, you know, how can I grow my AUM? And which businesses should I be in that that my brand can support? And I think that list of businesses they can be in is getting bigger pretty fast. Now, not every venture firm is going to be able to do that, though, just like not every buyout firm, you know, can be Carlyle Group. But, you know, Tiger Global at the moment looks like a disruptor. And certainly when the first Vision Fund was raised, they look like a disruptor.
And then MTech Capital.
Amen. Hope it happens. We're working on it.
Yeah. Well, after being on here, you'll be fine. are there some
appreciate
things
it.
That you wish the prospective companies that are looking for VC investment that you wish they already knew, or some misconceptions you wish they were disabused of?
That's an interesting question. Here's what I often say to entrepreneurs. They don't realize how much power they have in shaping their own financings. I often say this to entrepreneurs, and I don't know that they take it on board or don't feel as comfortable. But when a big VC fund shows up and says, listen, I need to own 20% of your company. You can't let any other investors in. We're going to lead your round, and we want all of your existing investors to step back, take less than their pro rata, et cetera, et cetera. Entrepreneurs. Yeah. Entrepreneurs think, no, not so much wash them out. Let's say that I'm an early investor and I own 10% of the company. And then a subsequent investor shows up and my 10% now of a $30 million round is, you know, $3 million. And I might be asked to step that back to, why don't you only take $1 million? Because we're going to let this big investor in and they want to write a check of a certain size. And so now I have to step back. All of those behaviors, okay. Entrepreneurs actually have a lot more say. And they could stand up to that lead investor and say, hold on a second. I know you want to do X, but I want you to do 70% of X. And I think it'll be in the best interest of the business if you only do 70% of X. And then they might say something like, well, if I don't get the number that I put on the table, I'm going to walk. And, you know, some percentage of the time they actually will. And then in many cases, they won't. And so my comment's a bit self-serving because I have a small fund, you know, $100 million fund. And sometimes funds like mine can't get into all the investment opportunities they would like because lead investors don't make room. And I try to tell entrepreneurs, you have a lot of control over the construction of your round. And
VC world and all the terms and how that works is a whole industry. And I can see where maybe they're not familiar with what's possible, what's out there all the time, as much as
you're
you
exactly
and,
right.
And the VC world might know. But you're saying
you're
maybe
exactly
even
right.
Bring those concerns up so that they can suggest a way to bridge the difference.
It's hard, right? You're maybe a first-time entrepreneur, or even if you're a seasoned entrepreneur, if your favorite investor wants to be your lead investor, you also want them to be happy. So it's a delicate dance, isn't it? Of, well, if I really ask them to cut back a lot, they'll be either unhappy or they'll walk. So I have to navigate these gates carefully. But there's still, that being said, entrepreneurs have a lot more power than they think they do in shaping rounds of financing.
That is an interesting comment from your side. Thankfully honest. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
They can say something. And I can imagine that's many times their life's work and can be very worried about their outcomes, their lives and a lot of their friends and family's money is on the line.
It is super stressful for an entrepreneur, especially in the early rounds of financing, where they're oftentimes just thankful that someone is excited about what they're building.
Oh, some validation as to that huge risk they just took.
Exactly.
Huh.
And, you know, it is 100% true. You know, entrepreneurs at the end are alone. You know, even if they've started a company with co-founders, if you're the CEO, you know, and you're the driving force in a business, you're alone, it feels like many times. And you're carrying the company on your shoulders with your team. And so when an investor shows up and says, I'm a believer, boy, that's uplifting. And you decide that you want to work with them. That's what makes great teams, I think, between VCs and their entrepreneurs, is your VC needs to be a believer in you and your company.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Certainly very interesting.
Thank you, Steve, John. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And if Brian McLaughlin from MTech Capital shows up at your door, just give in. Just accept whatever terms he gives you.
Sign the term sheet.
Yeah. Actually, that would be a pretty bad sign, actually, if they didn't think about their business carefully enough to look at that.
I hope they learned enough on your podcast today that they know what value we bring and what a resource we are. In which case, maybe they would.
Love yourself. Very important message.
I'll hold out for that.
All right. That's Brian McLaughlin, the partner and co-founder of MTech Capital. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.